This is Ocean Robbins, and I am so excited to welcome you to the final day of the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. I'm here with my dad and colleague, John Robbins. For the last 8 days, you've been hearing him interviewing some of the top food experts on the planet. Throughout this summit, my dad and I have been talking with each other about what we want to leave you with in this, our final event of the summit. And we're so excited to be with you now. At one level, this summit is about the brilliant speakers and about my dad as the extraordinary interviewer and mentor that he is for the movement, and about the fabulous Food Revolution Network team that's put this on. But at another, more important level, this summit is about you and about all the people who have signed up and stepped up. It's about the thousands of comments participants have submitted. It's about the more than a million hours that you and our other participants have collectively spent diving into these presentations, absorbing their wisdom, and applying them in life. So I want to begin this final presentation with my profound gratitude that you're here and that you've chosen to make learning about food and health and being part of the food revolution into a priority in your life. From my heart to yours, thank you. I'm also grateful that I get to be here now and to work with one of my greatest heroes and dearest friends, my dad, John Robbins. He's an inspiration to millions, and his books and work have helped to change the course of food history. I think part of what's made these interviews so special is that my dad is himself one of the world's most influential food movement leaders. He's the multi-million copy best-selling author of books like Diet for a New America and The Food Revolution. He's co-founder and president of the Food Revolution Network. He's inspired millions of people to make food choices that contribute to health, compassion, and integrity. And he's received dozens of awards for his decades of leadership and service. Hopefully, during the course of this summit, through his skillful interviews and the remarkable dialogues he's brought forward with our speakers, hopefully you've gotten a chance to see something of how wise and insightful this man is. Working with my dad is one of the greatest privileges in my life, and I am so happy to welcome now my dad and colleague, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean. What a beautiful introduction, and I'm glad to be here with all of you. And for those of you who may not know, let me share a little bit about my son and my colleague, Ocean Robbins. Ocean is a leader in his own right. He's co-founder and CEO of the Food Revolution Network. As a teen, he founded Youth for Environmental Sanity, or YES, which is a global youth leadership nonprofit that he directed for 20 years. He's an adjunct professor for Chapman University. And he's spoken in person to hundreds of thousands of people from many, many nations, probably close to 100. You may have gotten to know him a bit through his wise presence and profound insights throughout the summit. I feel so honored to work with him. Being his father is one of the greatest privileges of my life. And getting to work with him to bring you the Food Revolution Summit has been and is a tremendous joy to me.
We've got a lot that we want to share with you in this hour, and we want to leave you with knowledge, power, and grounded hope. To start things off, I want to ask my dad to put our conversation in context for the times that we're in.
Well, thank you very much, Ocean. Knowledge, power, and grounded hope. Grounded hope. I realize that even talking about hope today can sound naive. We're living in perilous times, deeply uncertain times. In the U.S., the public's trust in its government is at an all-time low. When John F. Kennedy was president, what percentage of the American public do you think said they trusted the federal government to look out for their welfare? It was then 80%. Today, that percentage has dropped to below 20%. Can you imagine what it was like to live in a time when the vast majority of people trusted the federal government to function on their behalf? Well, we aren't there anymore. The overwhelming majority of Americans are disgusted and they're fed up with the system as it is. And this is not true just in the U.S. All over the world, frustration with government policies and anger at the status quo seems to be building. It's as though the words status quo were Latin for utterly and irredeemably screwed up. Can you count on the government to safeguard your health and well-being? I think you know the answer to that. But what does this mean for your life? I think it means that now as never before, you must take charge of your own health, of the food you eat, and of the life you live. In the 60s, when 80% of Americans trusted their government to work in their best interest, what percentage of America's kids do you think had a chronic health condition? It was then 2%. What percent do you think it is today? Over 25% of our children today have chronic health problems. This is just so wrong, and it so needs to be made right. We have higher rates of obesity, diabetes, and chronic illness than any other population that's ever lived on this planet, even though we spend far more money on healthcare than any other nation in the history of the world. Do you see why you have to take charge of your health and your food? How many of our established political leaders have been willing to stand up to the aggregate power of the junk food conglomerates, the corporate agribusiness companies, the agrochemical polluters, the insurance companies, and the pharmaceutical industry? The result is painful. We're swimming in a toxic soup of 90,000 basically unregulated industrial and agricultural chemicals. We're worn down by a diet of corporate junk food and the incessant barrage of advertising. And it's not just our physical health that's suffering. So is our mental health. People in the U.S. are only 4% of the world's population, but we take more than half of the world's antidepressant drugs. Far too many of us are in anguish and despair. Suicide rates in the U.S. for white middle-aged women jumped by 80% in the last 15 years. Among girls 10 to 14, the suicide rate tripled. What does this have to do with the food you eat? A lot more than most people realize. The worse our diets, the more our bodies and minds suffer from nutrition-induced stress. The average American consumes nearly 2 tons of sugar during their lifetime. That's equal to the amount of sugar in nearly 2 million Skittles. Now, we know that eating too much sugar dramatically raises your risk of heart disease and cancer, diabetes and dementia, obesity. What do you think it does to your mental equilibrium? And speaking of Skittles, did you know that earlier this year, a massive truckload of Skittles spilled on a highway in Wisconsin? The Skittles, which were not wrapped in any way, were on their way to a feedlot to be used as cattle feed. Is this insane? We're feeding candy to cattle. But this is just another example of the bizarre and stunningly unhealthy ways we feed and raise the animals from whom we get industrial meats, dairy products, and eggs. The worse our diets get, the fatter and sicker and more unhappy we get. More than 2/3 of us are now overweight or obese. What's the U.S. government doing about it? Well, here's an example. In the United States, we've got a Department of Agriculture that's encouraging us all to eat more fruits and vegetables. That's good. But the very same Department of Agriculture, at the very same time, is spending tens of billions of dollars every year subsidizing the production of genetically engineered corn and soy, which ultimately brings down the price of factory-farmed animal products and highly processed foods. What sense does it make for us, as taxpayers, to be heavily subsidizing crops that every health authority is telling us we should be eating less of? What sense does it make for us to be doing almost nothing to subsidize the fruits and vegetables we're supposed to be eating more of? If there's a responsibility to spend the public's money in a way that's consistent with the public's health, shouldn't taxpayers be subsidizing the foods that are better for us? I find it deeply disturbing that today, almost two-thirds of the calories in the American diet come from ultra-processed food. That almost all of these ultra-processed foods contain unlabeled, genetically engineered ingredients. And that we're spraying the fields growing our foods with more and more poisons. Today, in the U.S., we're spending 18% of our entire gross domestic product on what we call healthcare. But really, should it be called healthcare? Wouldn't it be more accurate to call it disease management? Most of today's doctors are largely untrained in nutrition. Their medical training is focused on managing disease symptoms with drugs and surgery. Meanwhile, our diets are getting worse and worse, and our population is getting sicker and sicker. It saddens me greatly that our food is making too many of us fat and sick and bankrupt. It's time to eat like our lives depend on it, because they do. Whenever we eat, we make a choice. Whenever we choose a food, we either improve the world or we make it less. We either sustain the conditions that are conducive to life or we worsen and harm them. It's an act of courage and love to prepare healthy food for ourselves and for others and to speak out and educate people.
In that light, I want to acknowledge the importance of coming together with kindred spirits. In a world with so much food toxicity, with so many forces pulling us in the wrong direction, I think it's critically important to find people who can inspire us, call us forward, and reinforce healthy and life-supporting habits. Food can be so social. Throughout history, breaking bread and sharing a meal have been acts of communion and connection between people. But food can also be a source of division. Many families and relationships suffer when kitchens turn into conflict zones. You might even fear that if you really live your food values, you could end up feeling isolated or lonely. You might worry about not being able to share a meal with a loved one at a restaurant, missing out on a weekend barbecue, having to decline a friend's invitation for dinner, or being unable to eat in the cafeteria at work. One of our goals at the Food Revolution Network is to help you discover how you can bring friends and family along with you on a healthy eating path, and how you can build a new community of healthy eating allies. When you have a strong community behind you, it gets easier and easier to do the right thing. You'll find that most real friends want the best for you and want you to be healthy. When you know how to communicate artfully, you might be surprised by how many friends are inspired to join you. And you'll also find that your healthy eating choices can be a doorway to new friendships, deeper bonding, and stronger social ties. As you begin to benefit from shifting in healthy directions, you can pass your discoveries on to other people in your life. There are few things more rewarding than being a positive influence on people you love and helping them to lose weight, to heal from illness, or to achieve their health or life goals. There's an art to navigating complex social dynamics so that you can stay in your integrity without coming off like a killjoy.
And that can be a difficult art to learn. A lesson I've learned is that the more passionate I feel about something, the more important it is for me to be respectful of those who don't share my views. I remember, Ocean, that when you were growing up, you were amazingly passionate about being a vegetarian. And you had some run-ins with people who didn't, shall we say, share your convictions.
That's true. And I'm embarrassed to say that I learned about respectful communication through trial and more than my fair share of errors. I was born, as some of our participants might know, in the middle of the woods on a remote island in British Columbia, Canada. My parents practiced yoga and meditation for several hours a day. They grew most of their own food, and they named their kid Ocean. Our nearest neighbors were nearly a mile away, so social skills were not something I developed in any great abundance at the outset of my life. As you can probably tell, I come from a family that's pretty passionate about healthy food, and that's been the case since before I was born. I was raised eating a whole foods vegetarian diet, and at a very young age, I came to the conclusion that animals were my friends and that I did not want to eat my friends. When I was 5, our family moved to a suburb of Victoria, Canada, so that I could have other kids to play with and a school to go to. That was the first time that I'd been regularly exposed to other people eating meat. To be honest with you, at first, lunchtimes were a bit traumatic for me. I had come to the belief that it was morally wrong to kill animals for food. By second grade, I started to speak my mind. When lunchtime rolled around, I took it on myself to inspect the lunches of the other kids. I'd walk through the schoolyard informing my classmates that their Star Wars or Cabbage Patch Kids lunchboxes were actually functioning as coffins. I told Susie that her fresh chicken sandwich came from a bird that had probably only days before been murdered. I was passionate, and I was also strident. One day I told one of my best friends, Damien, that his beef sandwich was responsible for a murder, and I asked him if he thought that the death penalty should apply to the murder of animals. We got in a physical fight, and before long, Damien's beef sandwich was in the garbage, and I was in the principal's office. Around that time, my dad sat down with me, and we had a good long talk. He pointed out the irony that I was preaching compassion, but in practice, I was getting in fights with my friends over the contents of their lunchboxes. He suggested that it's always easier to influence people when we treat them with respect. Nobody likes having food or ideology shoved down their throats. That was a powerful learning moment for me, and one that I've been absorbing ever since. Years later, I heard a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, who told us, "You have no moral authority with those who can feel your underlying contempt." The fact is, when we judge people or hold them with contempt, we lose moral standing in our relationship with them. And at the same time, when we treat people with basic respect for their fundamental being, we actually deepen our capacity to be a positive influence. Now, of course, we all know people who do stupid stuff, and I am not talking about respecting everything they do. I am talking about the reality that if you want to help someone move in a positive way, you will be most effective if you have a fundamental sense of alignment with their soul.
I remember your first years of school, and to be honest, I sometimes wondered if I had erred or made a mistake as a father by sharing my deep concern for animals with you when I saw how zealous and militant you became. But as I listen to your story now, I'm touched that we really got through all that. And I greatly appreciate the journey you've taken and where you are now.
Me too. And I appreciate your part in it.
So much is at stake here. A woman wrote to us recently. Her name is Dorothy Prabhu. She grew up in India. Shortly after she met her and married her husband, Mark, the two of them moved to the United States. It was 1982, and they soon began eating a variation on the standard American diet. Over the years, Dorothy developed a series of health problems, including fibroids and chronic fatigue. Sometimes she struggled to find the energy to get out of bed in the morning. Dorothy's doctors prescribed drugs, some of which came with major side effects. She took them, but her health problems only grew worse. Her doctors never told her that diet might be a factor in her suffering. Instinctively, though, Dorothy felt that something better must be possible. She began to learn about nutrition from health expos, books, and radio shows, and in time, she came to adopt a whole foods, plant-strong diet. Today, her fibroids are gone, and she has more physical and mental energy than ever. But her husband, Mark, did not follow her lead. And in 2016, after a sustained bout with diabetes, she lost him to renal disease. They had been together for 36 years. Today, Dorothy lives with and is still trying to pay off her husband's medical bills. She also lives with the knowledge that if only her husband's doctors had been versed in nutrition, it's possible he would still be alive. She thinks Mark might have listened if they had told him to change his diet. And many studies have demonstrated that both diabetes and renal disease can often be reversed by a healthy diet and lifestyle. I'm grateful that Dorothy has her health now, but she wishes she could have her husband back. And what's so poignant to me is that her story and her husband's story are all too common.
This is personal. It affects every single one of us, and it affects the people that we love the most. It's also global. In 2013, a global collaborative of scientists led by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington completed the largest study of risk factors for death and disabilities ever conducted in human history. Their report was titled The Global Burden of Disease. It found that the number one cause of death in the world and the number one cause of disease and disability is our diet. In fact, these researchers concluded that dietary factors are causing 672,000 deaths per year in the United States alone. This means that more Americans are dying from diet-caused disease annually than died in all the years of World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and both Iraq wars combined. But this time, the enemy isn't another country. It's the food we're eating. We are basically digging our own graves with our knives and forks. When I reflect on all this, I'm reminded of a story that I've heard my dad tell. Would you be willing to share the fable about people falling off the cliff? Do you know the story I'm referring to?
Well, I do know the story you're talking about, and I would be happy to tell it. Once upon a time, there was a large and rich country where people kept falling over a steep cliff. They'd fall to the bottom and be injured, sometimes quite seriously, and many of them died. The nation's medical establishment responded to the situation by positioning, at the base of the cliff, the most sophisticated and expensive ambulance fleet ever developed, which would immediately rush those who had fallen to modern hospitals that were equipped with the latest technological wizardry. No expense was too great, they said, when people's health was at stake. Now the idea occurred to certain people that another possibility would be to erect a fence at the top of the cliff. When they voiced the idea, however, they found themselves ignored. The medical authorities explained patiently that while building a fence might seem like an interesting idea, it was actually far from practical, and that health was far too important to be left in the hands of people who were not experts. "Leave it to us," they said, "for with enough money we will soon be able to genetically engineer people who do not bruise or become injured from such falls." So no fences were built. And as time passed, this nation found itself spending an ever-increasing amount of its financial resources on drugs, surgeries, hospitals, and high-tech medical equipment. Money that could have gone to community services, decent housing, education, and good food, not to mention building safety fences, was not available to the people, for it was being spent on medical care for people who had fallen over the cliff. As the costs of treating people kept rising, growing numbers of people could not afford medical care. There were increasing numbers of homeless, and there were ever more hungry people, and there were families torn apart by the stress. Violence, gangs, and inner-city riots began to well up as outlets for the frustration and the despair people felt. The more people kept falling off the cliff, the more a sense of urgency and tension developed, and the more of the country's money was poured into the heroic search for a drug that could be given to those who had fallen to cure their injuries. When a few families who had lost loved ones tried to erect warning signs at the top of the cliff, they were arrested for trespassing. When some of the more enlightened physicians began to say that fences should be built and warning signs should be erected, representatives from powerful industries denounced them as health police. A fierce battle ensued, and finally, after many compromises, the medical establishment did issue warnings. Anyone, they said, who had already broken both arms and both legs in previous falls should exercise utmost caution when falling. Of course, this is just a fable.
Yes, just a fable indeed. Obviously, this sounds just a little bit like our medical system with its consistent lack of focus on prevention and on nutrition. Why do you think it is that with all that we now know about the role that diet can play in preventing and even reversing disease, so few doctors put serious attention into encouraging their patients to eat well?
I think most doctors would love to be able to help their patients live healthier lives and eat better diets and prevent disease. But one of the major obstacles is that they have no training in how to do that. There was a study published in the Journal of Biomedical Education in 2015. It found that the average physician graduates from medical school having received just 19 hours of nutritional education. I think a doctor who doesn't know about nutrition is like a firefighter who doesn't know about water. But today, only 25% of all medical schools offer even a single required course in nutrition. And stunningly, this is lower than the 37% of medical schools that did so 30 years ago.
And we want to change that. At the Food Revolution Network, we believe that every graduating physician should know about healthful eating and its role in preventing and reversing conditions like heart disease, hypertension, stroke, cancer, dementia, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. And we have a plan to advance towards this goal. Every medical student has to pass multiple examinations that are managed by the National Board of Medical Examiners to determine whether or not he or she will be allowed to graduate and to become a physician. Right now, little about science-based whole foods nutrition is included in these exams. So we've joined with Yale University Prevention Research Center founding director, Dr. David Katz, with the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, the True Health Initiative, and dozens of the leading nutrition-conscious physicians of our times in launching a campaign. Our goal is to get nutrition taught in medical schools. If questions about nutrition are included in the exams that students must take to graduate, then medical schools will want to make it a central part of their curricula.
We believe that once established medical institutions begin to treat food like the medicine it can be, we'll not only have healthier people, we'll have happier doctors and a healthier world. And along with our campaign to get nutritional education taught in medical schools, we have another campaign that we believe can also make a tremendous difference. We want an end to the routine use of antibiotics in animal agriculture. Here's why. Meat producers routinely feed animals antibiotics to make them grow faster and to help them survive the crowded and filthy conditions that are the norm in factory farms. A staggering 70% of all medically important antibiotics sold in the U.S. are used in factory farms. This leads to bacteria developing resistance and weakens the effectiveness of antibiotics in treating humans. This is so serious that many respected medical authorities are saying that if we don't get antibiotics out of factory farms, millions of people will die from bacterial infections that we have, up until now, been able to cure with antibiotics.
U.S. chicken producers have made progress in reducing the use of antibiotics. Restaurant chains such as McDonald's and Chick-fil-A, Subway and Wendy's, they've all committed to sourcing chicken that was raised without antibiotics. The Natural Resources Defense Council estimates that roughly 40% of the U.S. chicken industry has either eliminated or pledged to eliminate the routine use of medically important antibiotics. But what about the companies that produce pork, beef, and turkey?
Oh, we really need them to step up. They are so lagging on this one. And we need mandatory restrictions on the routine use of antibiotics across the livestock industry. We've known for decades that the misuse of antibiotics in livestock is undermining the medical efficacy of these drugs. But the Food and Drug Administration has done almost nothing to stop it. All we've seen so far from the FDA are a bunch of voluntary guidelines that are riddled with loopholes. As a consumer, there's a lot that you can do. If you eat animal products, you can choose to buy only meats that are organic or that are raised without antibiotics. You can call local restaurants to ask if the meat they serve is free of antibiotics. If it is, congratulate them. If it's not, you can tell them that you won't patronize them until they change. And you can also choose to avoid all animal products that come from factory farms.
We've been talking about two of the campaigns that are dear to us at the Food Revolution Network, which are getting nutrition taught in medical schools and getting antibiotics out of factory farms. And I'd like to switch gears now so that we can read and respond to a few of the thousands of questions and comments we've received here. I'm going to ask my dad to respond to this first one, which touches on issues I'm sure are on many people's minds. Emily from Sydney, Australia wrote, "Thank you for your inspiring leadership and for how much you care about people and the planet. I have a question because I am confused about something. I've been reading two of John's books, Healthy at 100 and The Food Revolution. I love them. Beautifully written and great information. Thank you. My question is about the focus on low-fat diets, particularly around intake of saturated fat and the links to Alzheimer's, heart disease, and cancer. I know that you interviewed Dr. Perlmutter and Dr. Hyman in the summit, and that they both have almost opposite views to you on this particular issue, though of course they agree with you on most other things, eat veggies, no processed foods, no white flour, etc. I know that both of the books I'm reading are from over 10 years ago, and I think that Dr. Hyman and Dr. Perlmutter's books are more recent. So I wonder if the dominant view from the research is changing over time. Can you please tell me, what is your current view on intake of fats, in particular saturated fats, and what fats do you eat?"
Well, thanks to Emily for that question, which I do think is on a lot of people's minds. In recent years, fat has been making a comeback from the days when it was demonized. Researchers have been questioning whether dietary fat is necessarily dangerous, and they've certainly shown that not all fats are created equal. For example, there's a particular group of fats, the omega-3 essential fatty acids, that are critically important for the brain's structural integrity and performance. We're hearing a lot today about the benefits of Mediterranean diets, which tend to feature nuts and olive oil. And in some quarters, the blame for obesity and heart disease has shifted from fat to carbs. The Atkins diet, and more recently the Paleo diet, have popularized the idea that you can get slim eating high-fat, low-carb foods. So, where do I stand now with all this? I think it's important to bear in mind that the only diet that's ever been proven to reverse advanced heart disease is a low-fat, plant-strong whole foods diet. This has been demonstrated by doctors Dean Ornish and Caldwell Esselstyn and others. If I had advanced heart disease, that's the kind of diet I would adopt. I agree with doctors Perlmutter and Hyman on a great many things. I don't agree with the emphasis they sometimes place on eating large amounts of fat. I think they overdo it. For most of us, I think it's important to get a decent amount of healthy fat in our diet, and the healthiest sources of fat are seeds and nuts and also avocados. In my kitchen, I have a dedicated coffee grinder that I use daily to grind flax and chia seeds. I use the ground flax and chia seeds in smoothies and in many other dishes throughout the day. My diet also includes other seeds and nuts and avocados on a daily basis, and once in a while, wild, low-mercury fish. I lean away, though, from bottled oils, which I consider to be processed foods for the most part, but I do enjoy a bit of olive oil and coconut oil.
Emily also asked about saturated fats, specifically.
Oh, yes, she did. The evidence still strongly points to saturated fat being dangerous, and I avoid it, with the exception of the saturated fat found in coconut and in chocolate. The saturated fat that is found in coconut and in chocolate is far less dangerous than that found in dairy products and meats and eggs. Dark chocolate contains flavonoids that have potent antioxidant and anti-inflammatory actions in the body. Dark chocolate with 70% or more cocoa solids actually has many positive effects on your health, and I love it.
In the last few years, we've been hearing a lot about studies that are reputed to exonerate saturated fat. Probably the most frequently cited study was published by Chowdhury et al. In the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2014. I'd love to hear, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners would also If you could talk about your response to that study and to the others that some are saying vindicate saturated fat.
I've looked very carefully at these studies, including the one you mentioned from the Annals of Internal Medicine. But they aren't saying what some people are saying they're saying. What these studies actually show is that when people reduce their intake of saturated fat and replace those calories in their diet with refined carbs and sugar, there's no advantage at all. They don't lower their heart disease rates or anything else. So there's no benefit to eating less saturated fat if it means you're eating more sugar and other refined carbs. But that doesn't mean that butter, cheese, and meat belong in a healthy diet. These studies are finding that sugar and refined carbs are just as bad. And there's something else these studies are actually saying. When people reduce their intake of saturated fat from dairy and meat products and replace those calories in their diet with either healthier fats or with healthier foods in general, they show dramatic improvements in many different biomarkers. They have much lower rates of heart disease and diabetes and obesity, and they benefit from many other positive health outcomes.
Thank you for that thoughtful and thorough answer to Emily's question. You know, with all the conflicting information that's out there, it's so important to cut through the noise so that we can understand what we actually know. We received another question from Fred in Illinois about a topic that I think is also on a lot of people's minds. He wrote, "We're seeing society breaking down in so many ways. It seems like people are more and more hostile and fearful. Is there any evidence that links antisocial behavior with the quality of a person's diet?"
There actually is a great deal of evidence about that. For example, there was a series of studies in the 1980s that removed chemical additives and they removed processed food and they reduced the sugar in the diets of juvenile delinquents. Over 8,000 young people in 12 juvenile correctional facilities were involved. The result was that deviant behavior fell 47%. In Virginia, 300 juvenile delinquents at a detention facility housing particularly hardened adolescents were put on the improved diet for 2 years. During that time, the incidence of theft dropped 77%, insubordination dropped 55%, and hyperactivity dropped 65%. In Los Angeles County probation detention halls, 1,400 youths were put on the improved diet, eliminating processed foods, chemical additives, and greatly reducing sugar. Again, the results were excellent. There was a 44% reduction in problem behavior and in suicide attempts. These studies and many other studies like them have found that when troubled youngsters are put on a healthy diet based on nutrient-dense foods like vegetables and fruits, seeds, legumes, and whole grains, and avoid sugar and artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives, the results are predictably outstanding.
There are two things I'd like to point out here, and they're both pretty significant. The first is that those are stunning studies that show criminality and antisocial behavior is being dramatically reduced with nutritional improvements. The second is that these studies took place over 30 years ago, and nothing has been done to seriously follow up on them or to implement their discoveries on a vast scale. When I think about all the parents and grandparents who stay up late worrying about their kids' future and about how many children and teens are struggling with hyperactivity and with feelings of confusion, maybe even hostility, I feel it's kind of an outrage that we're not acting on what we know, and that our kids are paying the price. And it's not just kids. The same foods that help kids to have emotional balance are also good for adults at every age and stage. But the good news is that now that we know, we can put what we're learning into action. We do not have to wait for our government, for the food industry, or for any more medical studies to take advantage of this life-saving information. When foods containing artificial additives are eliminated, and when foods high in sugar are reduced, and when people base their diet around more whole and natural foods, we consistently see amazing results. Whether we're looking at depression or diabetes, at happiness or heart health, lives change in powerful ways for the better.
They do. And this is also true, we're finding, with dementia, with Alzheimer's disease. You know, we've long thought that some form of cognitive decline is inevitable with aging. But we now have an earthquake of emerging evidence that cognitive impairment in older people is the result of decades of deterioration in the processes that power our brain cells, and that deterioration happens far less in people who eat healthy diets. Alzheimer's is not a disease of old age. It's a lifelong process that starts early and reaches a tipping point in our later years. But even in those people who are genetically disposed towards Alzheimer's disease, that process can often be abated with excellent nutrition. It turns out that both the heart and the brain are highly vulnerable to disruptions in blood supply. And the same diet that opens coronary arteries and protects against heart disease and often reverses heart disease also improves blood flow to the brain and protects against all kinds of cognitive impairments, including Alzheimer's disease. And that diet is a plant-strong, whole foods diet that emphasizes lots of fresh veggies and, in particular, green leafy vegetables. And this is quite exciting. Researchers from Rush University Medical Center in Chicago discovered just how important greens are in preventing Alzheimer's and in preserving mental clarity. They analyzed the diets and the cognitive function of about 1,000 seniors over a period of 5 years. What they learned was stunning. They found that those who ate at least one daily serving of green leafy vegetables had the same cognitive abilities as someone 11 years younger.
You know, that is fascinating, especially when you consider that half of the people who reach the age of 85 in the U.S. today have Alzheimer's. This is becoming an epidemic, and the fact that we know how to prevent it in many cases, and maybe possibly even how to reverse it, is extraordinarily good news. So now I want to turn us to another one of the questions that we hear a lot about, and that's GMOs. Monsanto and its allies repeatedly say that millions of people have eaten foods containing genetically engineered ingredients without a single substantiated case of any harm done whatsoever. And I'd like to ask my dad, is that true?
Well, it may be true, but it's very misleading. Here's why. Before it was known that smoking causes cancer and heart disease and is in 1,000 other ways damaging to human health, you could have said that millions of people have smoked cigarettes without a single substantiated case of any harm done whatsoever. No one ever smoked a cigarette and then keeled over and died from lung cancer. Smoking kills over decades as a result of the cumulative damage done by smoking many cigarettes. Just so, no one has ever eaten a meal of GMO foods and then keeled over and died. But what are the cumulative effects of eating GMO foods over years or over decades? We don't know. No studies of humans over years have ever been done, much less over decades. Now, researchers were eventually able to determine with scientific certainty that cigarettes cause not just lung cancer, but also heart disease, emphysema, bronchitis, miscarriages, and many other diseases. They were able to come to this conclusion with scientific certainty because they were able to compare the health outcomes of smokers to the health outcomes of non-smokers. Even at the peak of tobacco use, only about half of U.S. adults smoked. But today, because we don't have labeling, nearly everyone is unwittingly consuming genetically engineered food. Researchers may never be able to compare the health outcomes of those who eat GMOs to the health outcomes of those who don't, because just about everyone is eating GMOs, whether they know it or not. GMO foods could be as destructive and damaging as smoking, and we wouldn't know it. The fact is that public health has taken a dramatic downturn in the 25 years since GMOs came into widespread commercial cultivation and since they came into the food supply. There are, of course, many possible reasons for this, but we cannot rule out that GMOs could be playing a part.
It's true. And there's actually another major problem with GMOs that is indisputable. They were introduced with the promise that they would decrease the use of pesticides, but in reality, that's not what's happened at all. The truth is that these crops were never intended to reduce pesticide use. The companies that have developed GMO crops are Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, Syngenta, and Bayer. They're all chemical companies that make tens of billions of dollars by selling pesticides. And just a note of clarity, because some people are confused on this point, pesticides are chemicals that have been designed to kill. They include herbicides, which are toxins intended to kill weeds. They also include insecticides, which are intended to kill insects, and also fungicides and other highly toxic chemicals. In every case, the word "cide," which is also in suicide, by the way, means death. These chemicals kill. More than 90% of U.S. corn, soy, cotton, and sugar beets have been genetically engineered to withstand massive doses of the toxic herbicides that these companies make and profit from selling.
And the amount of herbicide that we're talking about here is staggering. Thanks to genetically engineered crops, more than 100 million additional pounds of Roundup are used on America's croplands each year. The result is toxic chemicals polluting our water and polluting our air, killing wildlife and native plants, and threatening the very survival of the monarch butterfly and other species. And this is definitely having a seriously adverse impact on human health. In 2015, the World Health Organization's research arm found that the active ingredient in Roundup, glyphosate, is a probable human carcinogen.
And in 2016, an FDA-registered food safety lab tested many well-known brands of American food products for residues of glyphosate. They found alarming amounts in almost every food they tested. And then just a few weeks ago, a team of scientists in Indianapolis announced they had found glyphosate in the bodies of 90% of pregnant women. They're very worried about the impact on infants because they have found a correlation between glyphosate in pregnant women and shortened pregnancies and below-average birth weights adjusted for age. The findings alarmed the researchers because such babies are at increased risk for diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and lower cognitive abilities as well.
Which is so sad. And meanwhile, the evidence that Roundup and glyphosate cause tremendous harm to humans just keeps growing. Just last month, California regulators announced the addition of glyphosate to the state's registry of chemicals known to cause cancer. And at the same time, a federal judge in California unsealed court documents indicating that Monsanto executives have lobbied officials at the Environmental Protection Agency to kill an investigation into the safety of glyphosate.
What is it, do you think, that they don't want us to know?
A lot. There is, in fact, a tremendous amount of evidence that the damage glyphosate causes goes way beyond cancer. Glyphosate is an endocrine disruptor. It's been linked to liver disease, to birth defects, and to reproductive problems in lab animals. It's been shown to kill beneficial gut bacteria in people. It damages the DNA in human embryonic, placental, and umbilical cord cells. And yet, in 2013, the EPA increased the amount of glyphosate allowed in food crops from 200 parts per million to 6,000 parts per million. They raised the allowable limit to 30 times what it had been.
I want to make something clear here. Raising the allowable limit had absolutely nothing to do with new understanding of safety. In fact, researchers are constantly discovering new dangers that are associated with glyphosate. So how has Monsanto responded to the mounting evidence that the hugely popular weed killer Roundup, which they make and profit from, is a severe health hazard to humans?
Newly accessible court papers reveal that Monsanto manufactured scientific studies affirming the safety of their star product and then paid scientists to publish them. In 2015, Monsanto executive William Haydens emailed his staff instructions to ghostwrite portions of a scientific study on the safety of Roundup and told them that he would tell scientists to, quote, just sign their names to the study.
Oh my, that's ghastly. I mean, faking science for profit and then putting all of us at risk. But I do want to ask, what about the claims that GMOs increase yields and that they're needed to feed the growing human population on this planet?
In 2009, the Union of Concerned Scientists published a definitive report called Failure to Yield, which made it clear that there's been absolutely no yield increase with genetically engineered crops. You know, if genetically engineered crops were aimed at feeding the hungry, as Monsanto says they have been, then Monsanto and the others would have developed seeds with certain predictable characteristics. They'd have developed crops with the ability to grow on substandard or marginal soils. They'd have developed plants able to produce more high-quality protein or with enhanced nutrient profiles. They'd have produced crops with increased yields that could be grown without the need for expensive machinery, chemicals, fertilizers, or irrigation. And they'd have developed seeds that would be inexpensive for farmers to purchase and freely available without restrictive licensing. But the truth is that not a single one of the genetically engineered crops now available has any of these desirable characteristics. And what does this mean? The only possible conclusion that I can see is that the genetic engineering of our food supply has never been about feeding the world's hungry. That's been the lie that's been used to pull the wool over our eyes. I'm hoping that we can lift the veil, that we can see the truth, and we can move on to an ecological agriculture that really will reduce and eventually eliminate pesticides, and that really will provide a secure and sustainable food future for us all. I look forward to the day when we no longer grow our food with poisons and instead grow it in ways that are non-polluting and in harmony with the well-being of the whole Earth community. And until we get there, we need to make choices as consumers. One of the choices many consumers are making is to avoid GMOs. If you live in the US or Canada or Australia, then they aren't labeled for you. So, Ocean, could you please tell us, for those participants who want to avoid eating GMOs, how best to do that?
Absolutely. Well, first off, the best way to be sure that food you're purchasing doesn't contain GMOs is to buy a certified organic food. When you get products labeled 100% organic, organic, or made with organic ingredients, none of the ingredients in these products are produced from genetically engineered crops. Products that are labeled as made with organic ingredients only require 70% of the ingredients to be organic, but they actually require that 100% of the ingredients are non-GMO. Another great way to be sure you're not eating GMOs is to look for non-GMO labels, like the seal from the Non-GMO Project. It's also helpful to know what exactly are the ingredients that are most at risk to be GMO. If a food product isn't organic or specifically labeled non-GMO, then it is likely that it is genetically engineered if it contains ingredients made from any of five crops. And those crops are corn, soybeans, canola, cottonseed, or sugar beets. Again, the five that you want to watch out for here are corn, soy, canola, cottonseed, and sugar beets. With corn, look out for corn flour, corn meal, corn oil, corn starch, and corn syrup. You also might want to be aware that other sweeteners such as fructose, dextrose, and glucose are often made from corn. Sugar that is not specified as 100% cane sugar is likely to come at least in part from genetically engineered sugar beets, because GMO sugar beets make up about half the total sugar supply that's used in North America. And with soy, you may want to watch out for soy flour, lecithin, soy protein isolates, and almost anything called vegetable oil or vegetable protein.
Well, thank you, Ocean, for that very helpful information. You know, very few fruits and vegetables for sale in North America, fortunately, are genetically modified. Very few are. Rumors abound that seedless watermelons are genetically modified, but those rumors are not true. The only fresh vegetables that might remotely be GMO are non-organic zucchini, yellow crookneck, squash, and sweet corn. And the only commercially genetically engineered fruit commercially available is papaya from Hawaii. About half of Hawaii's papayas are GMO. Now, a lot of people ask us about meat and dairy products.
Yes, they do. And here's the deal on meat and dairy products. If you want to avoid meat that's been raised on genetically engineered feed crops, buy organic, or look for the phrase 100% grass-fed. And be aware that many alternative meat products include ingredients made from soy. If the soy isn't organic or labeled non-GMO, then it's almost certainly genetically engineered. Almost all U.S. dairies feed their cows GMO grains and GMO alfalfa. And some U.S. dairy farms also inject a genetically engineered growth hormone into their cows to boost milk production. The only way to avoid this conclusively is to buy certified organic dairy products. There are, of course, many dairy alternatives available today, but some of those are made from soy. And again, if that soy isn't organic or labeled non-GMO, then it's nearly certain to be genetically engineered.
I think it's a shame that we don't have labeling of GMOs in North America, and that we have to work so hard to protect ourselves and our families if we don't want to consume them. But fortunately, the sales of certified non-GMO foods have gone from nothing to over $19 billion a year in just the last 5 years. And we're also seeing a dramatic rise in sales of organic foods, which of course are non-GMO, but go further because they're also grown without the use of synthetic fertilizers or pesticides.
Now, speaking about organic, some people say that organic food is elitist. How do you answer that?
Well, here's the thing. I know people who live in strawberry-growing areas in California. They told me of overhearing a couple of local kids playing Cancer Barbie, shaved heads, hospital gowns, and all. The incidence of cancer is so common among the people these children know, their families and their neighbors, that they have incorporated the disease as a normal part of their play. I find this heartbreaking. These are the kids of the farm workers who pick the food you and I eat. So the next time someone tells you that organic food is elitist, think of these impoverished kids playing Cancer Barbie because we spray toxic chemicals known to cause cancer on the fields growing our food.
You know, hearing about those kids makes me think about my own kids and about how sad it is that so many people, really of all ages, are suffering from our toxic food culture. And so often, it is the poorest and the most vulnerable who may be impacted the most. A few years ago, I walked into a 7-Eleven in West Oakland, California. I don't usually shop there, but I was in the neighborhood and I needed some batteries, so in I went. And in the checkout line ahead of me, there was a woman, probably in her 40s, with two small kids who seemed agitated. The woman looked bedraggled and exhausted. Her kids were tugging on her, and she looked like she could be about 50 pounds overweight. My heart went out to her when I saw the fatigue on her face. It seemed like she was having such a hard time. I don't usually make it a habit to look at the contents of other people's shopping baskets. Honestly, I think it's rude. But in this case, I was waiting in line with nothing much to do to pass the time, and I couldn't help but notice the sugary cereals and sodas, the processed meats and chips and ice cream and canned soups that were filling up her grocery bags. I started to feel a bit of judgment. I was thinking about this woman's weight and her fatigue and her children's apparent hyperactivity, and I thought about how they might be fueled by their diet. And that's when I noticed that she was paying for her groceries with food stamps. And then it hit me. The woman in front of me might very well be struggling to feed her family at all. And here I was, snootily judging her for the contents of her shopping basket. I felt embarrassed by how disrespectful my attitude had been. The family checked out and left for the parking lot. And as they walked out, I found myself sending a little prayer their way. It was a prayer for their health and for their happiness. But I also knew it was going to take a whole lot more than prayers to help this family and to help the millions of families like them to have access to the healthy food and the healthy life that they deserve.
It sure is. In 2014, almost 50 million Americans lived in households designated as food insecure. According to official definitions, this means that they have limited or uncertain access to adequate food. And while many of us associate food insecurity with images of starving people in Africa or Asia, the reality is that in the developed world it is linked more often with obesity.
Why is that?
Why? Because the poor often have to make do with the cheapest calories they can get. And thanks to our perverse system of subsidies, these are, with stunning frequency, the least healthy foods and the ones most strongly linked to obesity. Food insecurity and poverty have also been directly linked to increased incidence of cancer and heart disease and diabetes and most of the other lifestyle-fueled chronic ailments of our times.
You know, when I bought my batteries in that West Oakland 7-Eleven, I found myself thinking about the family that checked out in front of me, and I was wondering, how did it get this way? Why is it that people who are struggling already just to pay rent, just to feed their families at all, are the most likely to be suffering from diet-fueled and life-threatening illnesses that they, of all people, can least afford? Is it just the result of distressed people making poor choices? Or is it possible that there are also economic and social forces at work that force us all to swim upstream if we want to be healthy, and that harm the poor and the disadvantaged the most? No families are being forced to eat junk food, of course. But wouldn't it make more sense if we, as a society, made it a little easier to do the right thing? Isn't subsidizing junk foods, and in the process making healthy food more expensive by comparison, isn't that a little like rewarding people for not wearing their seatbelt and fining them for putting it on? What kind of a world would we have if instead of subsidizing sugar, processed foods, and grain-fed livestock, instead we made fruits, vegetables, legumes, nuts, and seeds, the foods that medical science tells us we should eat more of? What if we made those more affordable for everyone? What would happen if instead of subsidizing GMOs and other pesticide-heavy foods, we instead made organic foods more affordable for all? If government is going to impact the marketplace in any way, shouldn't it support healthy eating instead of tilting the food marketplace in the direction of processed junk foods that are killing millions?
Oh, I so think so. And that's why part of our mission at the Food Revolution Network is to see healthy food made accessible to all. If any of us goes hungry or can only afford poor quality food, this is not just unfortunate. This is a test of our basic human decency. And the fact is, working toward healthy food for all also means being part of the larger struggle to end racism and to bring a voice to the farmers and the farm workers, to the rural and urban poor, and to everyone who's suffering from the dominant and toxic food systems of our times.
The fact is that there's a movement growing, and you're part of it every time you choose fair trade, organic, locally grown foods, every time you support a restaurant or other establishment that pays its workers a living wage, and every time you vote at the ballot box or with your dollars for policies that truly value the people whose work makes it possible for all of us to eat.
The fact is that our government and big agribusiness have conspired to make profits more important than your health, more important than the environment, and more important than your right to know how your food's produced. But beneath the surface, there's a revolution growing. From rural farms to urban dinner plates, from grocery store shelves to state ballot boxes, people are rising up and taking action. We're reclaiming our food systems and our menus. We're taking responsibility for our health. Every day, I see signs of hope. Studies keep coming out showing the enormous healing power of healthful foods. We used to think that heart disease was an inevitable and irreversible sign of aging, but now we know how to prevent 95% of heart disease cases and how we can often reverse the damage that's already been done with a healthy diet. I love hearing that schools are serving better food and the result is happier kids. In many cases, schools are emphasizing plant-based proteins, and in the process, they're reducing the school's carbon footprint, serving healthier food, and saving money. It seems like every day more reports come out demonstrating the damage caused by processed food and the global dangers of industrial meat, and at the same time showing the enormous health and environmental benefits of eating a Whole Foods plant-strong diet.
Food's very personal, and it's also very political. Every bite that you take literally becomes you, and it also connects you to people, policies, and practices all over the planet. Today, there's a huge and growing demand for food that's organic, sustainable, fair trade, non-GMO, humane, healthful, and of course, nourishing and delicious. And in cities all around the world, we're seeing more and more farmers markets, community-supported agriculture programs, and more young people who are getting back into farming. Grocery stores, even big international chains, are displaying local, natural, and organic foods with pride. The movements for healthy food are growing fast, and we want to thank you for being part of them with us.
We do want to thank you. We're now nearing the end of the 2017 Food Revolution Summit. One of our top goals has been to help you realize how powerful you are and to see how your food choices can change your life and change your world at the same time. There are so many areas in our lives where we can feel powerless to truly make a difference. The systemic problems of our times can seem an awful lot bigger than any one of us. But when it comes to food and health, you and I have immense power. We have the power to choose what we take into our bodies. We have the power to vote with our dollars for the kind of food system we want. And we have the power to contribute in a tangible and meaningful way to the building of a more healthy, sane, and sustainable future for ourselves, for our loved ones, and for our planet. I believe that eating simple food in a healthy body with a clean conscience is more pleasurable and infinitely more satisfying than eating products that make you and your world ill. And I believe that together, one step and one bite at a time, one choice and one act of caring at a time, we're moving toward the more beautiful world that our hearts know is possible. May all be fed. May all be healed. May all be loved.
This is Ocean Robbins and John Robbins and the entire team of the Food Revolution Network, thanking you so much for joining us in this summit and for all the ways that you participate in the food revolution. This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.